It is Tuesday, April 10th, 2012. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. In a moment, the return of a statue of J. William Fulbright to the University of Arkansas campus. And a visiting scientist to the University of Arkansas explains what secrets the submerged land known as Doggerland holds.
KUAF is supported by Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, celebrating the American spirit by uniting the power of art with the beauty of nature. The museum opens at 11 a.m. daily, except Tuesdays. More information available online at crystalbridges.org.
Everyone here at KUAF wants to say thank you to the nearly 1,200 contributing listeners who donated more than $150,000 during our Spring On Air fundraiser. You've shown, once again, how public radio can be supported by those who care enough to call and contribute. Thank you for making KUAF possible for your community.
A new landmark on the University of Arkansas campus is back at its rightful place now, returned yesterday afternoon. Ozarks at Large's Ithi Agnihotri-Madolker made a trip to Old Main's West Entrance to take part in the 107th birth anniversary celebration of the former United States Senator and Fayetteville native J. William Fulbright.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us today for the first of what will become an annual celebration of the birth of J. William Fulbright.
Dean Robin Roberts of J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas welcomed students, faculty, and other members of the campus community to a gathering yesterday afternoon. The function on the west entrance of Old Main was hosted by Fulbright College to celebrate not only the 107th birth anniversary of its namesake, former United States Senator and Arkansas native J. William Fulbright, but also the return of a statue to the campus.
Many people have commented on how they have missed seeing the statue as they've walked around campus. And I can tell you that especially for those of us who work, teach, and study in this building, his return is very welcome.
Dean Roberts was joined by Associate Dean of Fulbright College, Dr. Charles Adams, and University of Arkansas Chancellor, Dr. G. David Gearhart, both former Fulbright scholars.
Welcome home, Bill Fulbright, and happy birthday. You look pretty good for 107.
According to the director of U of A's Fulbright Institute of International Relations, Professor Hoyt Purvis, who also served as the press secretary and special assistant to J. William Fulbright, the statue of the former university president and U.S. senator was dedicated in October of 2002.
A woman named Greta Bader in Washington, who was a friend of Senator Fulbright's and knew him quite well, she actually executed the sculpture, the statue, and former President Clinton was here. Of course, he had worked in Senator Fulbright's office while he was a student at Georgetown and had a very close relationship with Senator Fulbright. And it also coincided with the 50th anniversary of the German-U.S. Fulbright Exchange Program.
The statue was removed last year due to concerns about its safety and preservation during nearby construction projects. Yesterday's audience was also addressed by Missy Mara Mara, a Fulbright scholar from Philippines who's currently pursuing a Master of Fine Arts degree in drama at the university. Mara Mara said the impact of Fulbright scholarships on enhancing and improving communication among citizens of the world has helped answer the question, quote unquote, how does one bring home the expansive world?
The answer perhaps can be found in what Senator Fulbright said. Educational exchange can turn nations into people, contributing as no other form of communication can to the humanizing of international relations.
Mara Mara is also a member of a registered student organization that represents the many former and current Fulbright scholars from 20 different countries on the University of Arkansas campus. Dr. Gearhart, who visited Oxford University in England as a Fulbright scholar, said that opportunity is the word that describes the scholarship program best.
The Fulbright Fellowship certainly gave me a life-changing opportunity to study at Oxford University, where Senator Fulbright himself once studied. It gave me the opportunity to break out of familiar settings, the opportunity to pursue studies unavailable back at home, and simply the opportunity to see things through an entirely new lens. I find that traveling and studying abroad has the fascinating effect of making the world feel infinitely larger, yet somehow smaller as well.
The return of former U.S. Senator J. William Fulbright's statue to its place of honor at the west entrance to Old Main on the University of Arkansas campus was celebrated yesterday afternoon. The celebration also marked Fulbright's 107th birth anniversary. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Ithi.
Yesterday's ceremony surrounding the return of the statue of Senator Fulbright reminded some of us at Ozarks at Large of a similar ceremony.
On September 9th, 1991, the real J. William Fulbright was standing in front of the east side of Old Main. He was participating in the rededication of the oldest building on campus after it had been empty for nearly a decade. Old Main had been a large part of his life. He had attended public school there, had studied inside its walls during his college career, and had served as the university's president before he went to Washington. On that fall day more than 20 years ago, he allowed the newly refurbished bell tower to upstage him for a moment.
It's a great pleasure for me, after all these years, to participate in this ceremony. This building was my educational home for about 15 years. From the time I was six, I used to live just a few blocks down this way, and I walked to the school, the primary. I think we ought to listen to this bird. That's wonderful. It's a great friend. And the beautiful chimes. Right on the button. Right on the button. That's a lovely sound. I grew up just south of here. I lived about six blocks down and used to walk to school in the first grade in the bottom of Old Main there, where when I was about 6 years old when I started. Took me a while, about 15 years to graduate. A little longer than most of you, but most of you didn't go to the first grade either in Peabody. Then it moved down to the Peabody, used to be down there, and I continued here until I graduated in 1925. Well, I don't think I was so stupid, it just wasn't in a hurry those days. And then I went abroad to study. Well, it's a question whether I should really try to instruct you about the ancient times, but Old Main does occupy a very special place in my life.
That was Senator J. William Fulbright speaking in front of Old Main on September 9th, 1991, as the building was rededicated and reopened. Yesterday, a statue of Senator Fulbright was returned to its place on the west side of Old Main.
At the bottom of the North Sea is a lush plain that not that long ago, at least not that long ago in geological time, was home to hunter-gatherers. But rising sea levels completely submerged the land, now called Doggerland, by the year 5500 BC. Vincent Gaffney, the chair in landscape archaeology and geomatics at the University of Birmingham in England, is the leader of the North Sea Paleo Landscapes Project. That project is using 3D seismic data to further study Doggerland. This week, he's on the University of Arkansas campus. Tonight at 6:30, he's delivering a lecture about the secrets of Stonehenge. But yesterday, he discussed his study of Doggerland. And before that lecture, he stopped by the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio.
In the last 20,000 years, the shape of the world changed dramatically. large portions of the land, terrestrial land, were inundated as the temperature warmed, as the glaciers retreated in the northern hemisphere, and sea level rose, and it covered up areas which had been home to men and women for thousands and thousands of years. These were areas which people knew, the hills they were named, the rivers they knew, the land they lived on, and they were just lost to history and memory.
But now, thanks to technology developed thousands of years later, we can learn more about it, can't we?
Absolutely. And the area we're talking about, just to give you some sort of idea, the area I work in is Northwest Europe, and that's sort of bounded by France, Britain, and Norway. And at the time we were talking about, initially from 18,000 BC, the frontier of Europe was up near Norway. Britain wasn't an island, and everyone's very used to, I think, the shape of Britain, and the British are very used to the shape of Britain, and you know, we define ourselves as an island race. But then it was just a range of hills on the edge of Europe, nothing more. And over time, the world changed what it is today, and you know that makes us in many ways. But in the past, it was very different, and now we've managed to find ways of starting to explore that.
I would imagine that it has been for some time difficult to study. I mean, you're talking underwater.
Let me tell you just how difficult and why this is quite so interesting. 10 years ago, I regularly held a seminar on strange landscapes, and in one of those seminars, we treated the Mesolithic. Now, the Mesolithic is the Middle Stone Age. It's a period from about 10,000 BC through to about 5,000 to 4,000 BC in the British Isles, and it's interesting for one specific reason for me, because in 1931, a British trawler called the Kalinda was pulling in its nets, and the skipper, a guy called Pilgrim Lockwood,
that's a great name,
wonderful name, was breaking up the Moorlog. Now, the Moorlog were great big bits of peat that were scraped up from the bottom of the seabed, and he was hacking cumbersome for the fishermen, because they damaged the nets, they bruised fish, they didn't want this stuff, but they kept on dragging it up, and they had for at least 100 years previously, and you know, mechanized trawling produced even more of the stuff. But he was hacking a meter cube of this stuff up when his shovel hit something, and he pulled it apart, and inside was a rather beautiful bone harpoon.
Huh.
It had inscribed lines on it. It was serrated, and he looked at it and he thought, that's interesting. I rather think he thought he could sell it, because he actually says he found it by taking this big lump of stuff down into his cabin, and he broke it open just to see what it was before the rest of the men. But he took it back to Britain, and it went to the British Museum, and it was studied, and they said, yes, this is from this period called the Mesolithic, and it's rather interesting. Why is it out in the middle of the North Sea, near the Lamanadua Banks, which is not far from the famous Dogger Banks in the North Sea? And he then showed it to some academics in Cambridge, and they looked at it, and they said, this is interesting, because we don't think it was just dropped in the middle of the North Sea. Some passing person on a canoe didn't drop it. And what they did was they actually took a sample of the peat from nearby, and they analysed it through the pollen that was held in the material, and they realised that at that point in time the area had been dry land.
Huh.
And it wasn't just a passing boat. It had to be someone walking across the North Sea. Now, that shouldn't have been such a surprise, because 20 years earlier, a guy called Clement Reid who was a member of the British Geological Survey, had in his retirement produced a book on submerged forests. Now, he had looked at forests which were fossilised but were preserved below the waterline, and he'd realised that at some point areas much beyond the terrestrial landmass of Britain must have been dry land. And by studying these, he had suggested that all the area below the 36-metre bathymetric point, that's about 100 metres below sea level, must have been dry land. And he realised that the North Sea itself would have been a great big plain. Now, he understood it was important. He said that this is an area where people would have been better to live there than anywhere else at that point in time. But he couldn't date when this land existed, and it was inaccessible. And he made this comment. He said, "Well, even though everything an archaeologist might wish to study might be there, preserved underwater, all the wood, the textiles, and everything else," he said, "actually, what I think is going to happen is that the geologists are going to look at this and say too recent, and the archaeologists are going to look at it and say too old, and everyone is going to pass on." And he's absolutely quite right. That was actually what happened until the find from the Kalinda.
If you are in the study of geology or archaeology or a related field, this is not surprising to you. But, you know, you're asking lay people to rethink about the world in a way they're not used to. And it kind of grounds you, I think, to realize that things do change and can change again.
Yes, and perhaps it's an appropriate tale for current times. There is, of course, a huge debate upon climate change, but this period we're talking about was the last one during which climate change of a scale that we are anticipating occurred within the world. Now, I'm not saying it was man-made. That would be preposterous. It's an entirely natural event. And you may derive whatever you wish about the current debate about what is driving climate change. But the chances are that climate change is real, and chances are it is likely to be catastrophic, and to some extent it is likely to be catastrophic. You have to put against that what happened 20,000 years ago through to about 5,500 BC. During that time, Europe lost 20 to 30% of its land area. Mm. The people who lived in that land were pushed off. There is undoubtedly evidence for a rise in violence during this time. There's evidence for changes possibly in respect of land ownership and tenurial patterns, possibly caused by stress from movement of population at various times. Well, we can be quite sure that the change which was enforced at this time was problematic and deeply distressing, but people had the capacity to change. They were probably able to move. The population stabilised in a land that was generally underpopulated. In the future, where are all our cities? Mm-hmm. They are all on the coasts.
Right.
Where are these people going to go if there is major climate change and sea level rise again? Now, I'm not going to suggest that the scale of rise will occur in exactly the same way. There was about 120 metres rise after 18,000 BC. Mm. Now, that may not happen, but relatively small amounts of change is likely to have large impacts on large populations around the world.
Is there any way to know how quickly that rise happened?
Well, the pace of change is very difficult. We really do not have that information at the moment. It will require a lot more evidence for that refined chronology. I mean, we know where the coastline started at the end of the last ice age. We know where we begin, but the change was probably not linear.
Right.
There were major changes in quite short times when for instance, great ice lakes in North America, the dams burst. There were rapid changes in sea level rise in the North Sea as well. So that could happen very rapidly. In most cases, the change was insidious. It took a long time, but at other periods, it could have been quite short periods.
Vincent Gaffney is the chair in landscape archaeology and geomatics at the University of Birmingham in England and the leader of the North Sea Paleo Landscapes Project, studying the area at the bottom of the North Sea called Doggerland. And tonight at 6:30, as part of the Sigler Lecture Series at the University of Arkansas, he'll discuss the secrets of Stonehenge.
Yes, we'll be looking at real secrets. We're going to be looking in between the monuments of Stonehenge, at the areas where people have never looked and finding out what is there.
That's part of the discipline here, right? Looking where people haven't looked before.
Absolutely.
But with Doggerland and with Stonehenge.
Yeah, people should always understand most of the world is actually terra incognita. It has never been explored.
That lecture about the secrets of Stonehenge is tonight at 6:30 in room 148 of the J.B. Hunt Building on the University of Arkansas campus. It's part of the Sigler Lecture Series and is sponsored by the Department of Anthropology, the Department of Geosciences, and the Environmental Dynamics Program. This is Ozarks at Large. The president of Northwest Arkansas Community College, Dr. Becky Panites, says she will retire from that post in June 2013. She made the announcement last night at the school's Board of Trustees meeting. She's been the president of Northwest Arkansas Community College since 2003. During her tenure, the school was able to raise $69 million in private and public funding, establish 5 learning centers to broaden post-secondary educational opportunities in nearby communities, and form a partnership with the National Child Protection Training Center.
More than 40% of students who receive Arkansas Lottery scholarships don't qualify to keep those funds for a second school year. A report to the Legislative Oversight Committee of the Arkansas Lottery Commission breaks down the distribution of scholarships by several factors, including race, gender, and county. Shane Broadway, interim director of the Arkansas Department of Higher Education, says his department is working to make students aware of the scholarships and help them keep the awards.
Anytime a student doesn't retain a scholarship, it's certainly a concern. What we want to try to find out more is what is causing them, more than likely. We know that the two biggest issues for a student not to finish college once they get there, one is they're not academically prepared enough to handle the rigors sometimes of college. Secondly, it's financial.
The report also found many more female students are applying for lottery scholarships than male students.
The average cost for a gallon of gasoline in Arkansas is up another 3.5 cents over the last week. That's according to the website ArkansasGasPrices.com. That tracking site says the average gallon of gas in the state now costs $3.78. That's still below the national average of $3.91.
Former Democratic legislator Fred Smith will not be running for a seat in the Arkansas House this election. Pulaski County Judge Mary McGowan ruled Monday that because Smith had not been cleared of his felony conviction before filing day, he is ineligible to run. Spokesperson for the Democratic Party of Arkansas, Candace Martin, says the party brought the case to court itself out of a duty to citizens.
From the onset of this process, our number one priority has just been to ensure that Arkansas law was maintained and that the people of that particular state representative district had representation that was able to fulfill the requirements as set out by the law.
Because Smith has since been cleared of his charge of theft of property delivered by mistake, he may be able to run in the future.
The University of Arkansas gymnastics team is now ranked 8th in the nation. That's after qualifying for the national championship meet. Arkansas will head to the NCAA championships in Georgia that began on April 20th. This weekend, Arkansas plays 2nd in the NCAA Southeast Regional, held at Barnhill Arena. This is the 6th time in 7 years the Arkansas team has qualified for the national championship meet.
The Arkansas Razorback baseball team meets Oklahoma in Norman tonight. Arkansas is ranked 11th in the country after taking 2 of 3 from Georgia this weekend in Fayetteville.
Theater Squared Season 6 concludes with The Fall of the House, playing Thursday through May 6th at Walton Art Center's Nadine Baum Studio. In this mystery, spanning 2 centuries, T2 artistic director Robert Ford explores the desperate bargains we make for love. Tickets and more information for The Fall of the House available at theater2.org or 443-5600.
KUAF is proud to co-sponsor the 2012 Susan G. Komen Race for the Cure. This 10K and 5K race, plus a 1-mile family walk, will be held on Saturday, April 28th at the Pinnacle Hills Promenade in Rogers. A pre-race pasta party will be held on Friday, April 27th. Race forms, pasta tickets, and more information are available at KomenOzark.org or 750-PINK.
It's Tuesday, the 10th of April, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
With us is Becca Martin Brown. She is the features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
You got all the parts right. Congratulations.
Thank you.
We're working on it.
Yes.
I don't know who I am right now either. Tonight, Boston Mountain Brass Works in concert at 7:30 at the Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall at the University in Fayetteville. That show is free. Mm-hmm. And Straight No Chaser, a cappella group, is performing at 8 o'clock at the Fort Smith Convention Center. Tickets start at $29 at Ticketmaster.com.
All right. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
At All Things Considered, we don't just bring you the day's news. We interview actors, musicians, and artists of all stripes and take the time to understand what really drives them. We learn the story behind the story to get at the deeper truths that connect us all. I'm Melissa Block. Stop by for your daily dose of discovery every afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered, every afternoon, Monday through Friday, beginning at 3 on KUAF 91.3 FM.
A new midnight theater production is being staged by professional actor and playwright Keith Scales at the Crescent Hotel in Eureka Springs on the life of Norman Baker. Baker operated a popular and unorthodox cancer hospital at the Crescent in the 1930s, where many, the myth goes, perished. Some claim the hotel has been haunted ever since. Charismatic and controversial, Norman Baker has for decades been shrouded in mystery. But Keith Scales spent a year researching the historical record and has brought Baker to light. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich met with Keith Scales and the Crescent Theater to discuss his endeavor.
Some people think of Norman Baker as being like a Nazi butcher. Some people think of him as just a heartless con man. And some people think of him the way he described himself, as a natural healer who was just way ahead of his time and challenged the medical authorities at the time and fell victim to prejudice against experimental medicine.
Keith Scales, a London native, playwright, film, and classical theater actor, moved to Eureka Springs last year from the West Coast to concentrate on the creation of original work for page, stage, and screen. When he learned the Crescent Hotel needed a manager to run its popular ghost tour attraction, he took the job for cash. He oversees 6 tour guides. And that's when he first ran into the legend of Norman Baker, who operated a cancer hospital in the Crescent 80 years ago. And many of the Crescent's ghosts are traced to Baker, who supposedly caused the death of hundreds of patients, filling the hospital morgue in the basement and raising lots of unanswerable questions.
And I would be asked questions by people who were on the tour and pretty much have to fabricate answers to them because a lot of it just did not add up.
But he wanted the facts and was commissioned by the hotel to research Baker's life so that he could script an accurate performance monologue. He traveled to Baker's home in Muscatine, Iowa, to examine the record. Norman Glenwood Baker was born in 1882, one of 10 children to an inventor father and mentally ill mother. Half his siblings, along with his dad, died prematurely. As a young man, he dabbled in vaudeville and mentalism, then later fabricated and patented the first air caleophone, a portable pipe organ, think circus music, which made him a good deal of money. He eventually found his voice operating his own high-powered transmission radio station in Nuevo Laredo along the Texas-Mexico border, part of the so-called Border Blaster era. Baker preached a positive message to a nation overcome by the Great Depression, also convincing them about natural healing and the power of the mind, inculcating hundreds of thousands of followers, Scales said.
And my perception is that the reason he became interested in it was because there was a lot of money to be made in it.
And savvy at mail order, Baker sold health cures, especially cancer formulas. And in 1929, he opened the Baker Institute in Muscatine to conduct inpatient cancer treatment using his own secret remedy.
I called it secret remedy number 5. We know what was in it. It was herbs. And I can give you the recipe if you like. It was composed of what he called very carefully measured quantities of ground up watermelon seed, red clover, brown corn silk, glycerin, peppermint, and a little carbolic acid as an escharotic.
An escharotic, like zinc oxide or bloodroot, is said to kill cancerous tissue. The other ingredients are today characterized as strong antioxidants. Baker had no medical training or degree, so hired physicians and nurses, likely with questionable references, to administer the injections and treat patients. They did no surgery or x-ray therapy, both conventional cancer treatments at that time.
The fact is that people came to Norman Baker after they had pretty much tried everything else. They were pretty much terminal when they came to Norman Baker. And even though the ingredients that are in those herbs may be great preventatives, I don't believe that they helped anybody who was terminal.
Norman Baker was part of a vocal anti-medical establishment movement that espoused via his popular radio broadcasts a philosophy known as natural hygiene, the use of herbal remedies, fresh foods, clean water, and exercise to cure disease, today called naturopathy. But the American Medical Association, founded in 1847 to advance scientific-based standards and practices, saw Baker and others like him as fakes and opportunists. They, conversely, viewed the AMA as a controlling medical monopoly run by powerful Jews. In the end, the AMA shuttered Baker's Muscatine Clinic, as well as another near Laredo. And the then Federal Radio Commission, today the FCC, pressured by the AMA, killed Baker's border radio operation, wrecking his best and most lucrative advertising medium. Still, Baker pushed forward to build a chain of cancer clinics, fashioned after the popular holistic Kellogg TB Sanatorium. And he set his sights on a dilapidated Victorian-era health spa in the Ozark Mountains, Eureka Springs.
In 1937, there were 1,700 people here desperate for somebody to come from outside and provide some work for the locals. The Crescent Hotel had been sitting empty for 3 years, and it was going cheap, and it was an existing facility. So he bought this place and the two parks around it, 28 acres altogether, for $40,000 and converted it into a cancer-curable hospital as the first step towards something that would rival the Mayo Clinic in his imagination.
He set about investing another $50,000 to renovate the Crescent into a 100-bed medical facility, complete with a penthouse suite for himself. The Baker Hospital opened in 1938. There's no written record of why he did this, Scales said, but Baker painted portions of the hotel using what appears to be sacred geometry and chromotherapy or color therapy. The theory goes that color stimulates certain healing responses. Red benefits the kidneys, green promotes good heart function, blue helps the throat. Baker himself was smitten with the color purple. He wore it, drove a lavender convertible, and painted the hotel in it. Supposedly, and there's no indication that Baker espoused this, purple stimulates the nervous system, cerebral cortex, and pituitary gland, and connects to universal energies, as well as transmits ideas and information.
When he took the hotel over, it had been sitting empty for 3 years, and before that, for a quarter of a century, it was a conservatory for young ladies. So it was very somber and Victorian, And he came in and he painted it in the most garish colors. His defenders say that it was Art Nouveau. I think it looked more like a circus. And his justification was that he wanted a place where people could feel cheerful and healthy and actually get better and would lift their spirits rather than a dull place where they could sit around and feel miserable.
You can still see remnants of Baker's chromotherapy on the hotel's purple brick chimneys. And according to the record, U.S. Congressman Claude Fuller, a native and then patriarch of Eureka Springs, claimed that Baker Hospital brought great prosperity to Eureka Springs.
Claude Fuller, who was a congressman in Eureka Springs and initially at least a friend of Baker's, told Congress that at any given time, Baker had 500 to 600 people in Eureka Springs taking his alternative cancer treatment. What that means is that they could not all be accommodated in the Crescent Hotel, so everybody in town was opening up rooms thanks to Norman Baker. Everybody was making a lot of money here.
Keith Scale says we don't know much about Baker's personality, but according to old photographs, Baker was exceedingly handsome. And combined with his mentalist abilities, he could sway an audience.
This was a man with many faces, as well as many talents, and many ways of manipulating other people. It does seem that people who knew him very well didn't come off very well from the relationship. People who didn't know him at all thought he was charming, until he got to know him very well and tried to do business with him, and he always came out the winner.
But in the end would lose a protracted and very public battle with the AMA that sought to crush Baker and others like him, most notably John Brinkley and Harry Hoxie, also making millions off natural cures, some of them extreme. 20 months after the Baker Hotel in Eureka Springs opened, it closed. The AMA contended Baker was practicing medicine without a license, preying especially on uneducated working poor and the desperate. That charge never stuck, but he was tried in federal court in Little Rock.
He was charged with fraud, fraudulent use of the U.S. mails. And the fraud was that he was bringing people to Eureka Springs on the promise that he could cure them when he knew he couldn't. Well, they convicted him.
While in prison, Scale says, Baker invented a power of thought mail order course based on the theory of auto-suggestion. And after his release, he attempted once more to open a health facility at Muscatine, but failing that, moved to Miami, Florida, where he lived for the next 15 years on a yacht owned by railroad tycoon and robber baron Jay Gould. Baker died in Florida in 1958 from cirrhosis of the liver, complicated by a carcinoma. Although he married briefly younger in his life, he had no descendants. Court case documents, Keith Scales found, state that Baker had accumulated $4 million in profits, equivalent to $52 million today.
And nobody knows what he did with all his money, because he never put money in banks, or very, very little. He kept it, what he said was, a cold, hard cash in a good hiding place. That's my idea of financial security. And so there's a lot of money still missing.
And Baker Hospital medical records have long disappeared. So who ended up surviving treatment and who ended up in the Baker Hospital morgue will never be known.
And one of the sightings that has been reported over the years is that people in the laundry have seen a man walking through wearing a white suit and a purple shirt on his way, apparently, to the area which is now the maintenance department, but used to be the morgue.
Norman Baker, checking on the status of his supply chain? Maybe. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
You can see Keith Scales perform at the Crescent Hotel Midnight Theater every Friday and Saturday at 11 p.m. Purchase your tickets at the front desk. And after, expect to pay a visit to the old morgue.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Wayne Bell. He writes the column Culture Club for FayettevilleFlyer.com. Wayne, how are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Good. It's the 10th day of April, and this has turned into a month, a busy month in the popular culture world. Books, movies, magazines, kind of coming out of our winter doldrums, I guess.
Yeah. TV has certainly provided us with the most entertainment, I guess, for this month earlier this month with Mad Men and The Killing and Game of Thrones kind of coming back after hiatus. So the month started out better than maybe it's going to finish up. But all in all, it's not the dead zone it once was.
Right. So what else do we have to look forward to in April?
Well, last week you had some new music releases from Nicki Minaj and the week before from Madonna. So that should help the music industry a little bit as we go forward. And then over this past weekend, of course, saw Titanic 3D.
Yeah, so this is the movie Titanic that came out years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been reconfigured to be 3D now. So the crash happens right in your lap.
From what I have read about it, it's James Cameron, so he didn't do it shoddily. Because mm-hmm. a lot of times the movies that come out that are redone in 3D, they don't look very good. You almost have to film them in 3D. But he redid it, and I heard that there were some pieces of the ship in the early scenes of the underwater dive that kind of come out just to wake you up. And then after that, it's more subtle. So I think that could be interesting, but it didn't do that hot over the weekend, mainly because we all have it in our library probably. So
And if a movie's in 3D, that ticket is almost always more than a regular movie, right?
Right.
So and you're asking people to pay more for a movie that they've probably already seen.
Plus, it can't inevitably do as well as some of the other 3D releases because it's just long.
Right.
So.
Oh, yeah, sure. It's like 3.5 hours or something, isn't it?
Yeah, but between that and American Reunion coming out this weekend, I thought I was back in like the late 90s. I was really strange.
And American Reunion is the
fourth in that American Pie series that started when I was in high school, so.
And I guess the big thing, I haven't seen any of those movies, but I guess the big thing is that all of the original cast members are back.
Wow. It must have been hard with all of their busy schedules.
But, I mean, you know, yeah. I have a feeling that the earlier sequels did not. They had the name in the movie title, but not the characters.
I wouldn't know.
Okay. But anyway, that's
how it must have been hard to get Jason Biggs and Tara Reid and from all of their commitments. I mean, whether they're accepting a Pulitzer or whatever, I mean.
But anyway, that comes out Friday.
Right. Okay. And then over the weekend, we had some new television start back up. The Big C and Nurse Jackie both started on Showtime. So that kind of kicks their season in. And then starting today, we have some new releases on DVD, The Iron Lady with Meryl Streep, which finally got her an Oscar again. It comes out on DVD. And that should be a pretty good format for that film because she's really great. The movie is kind of like a Lifetime movie, but she's really great. And then Bonnie Raitt has a new CD coming out tomorrow, Slipstream, which has got really good reviews in the press. And then on the 11th, Don't Trust the Bee in Apartment 23.
That's tomorrow. Now, this is a situation comedy, a sitcom, right? It's on ABC.
And it looks like it could be somewhat entertaining. It has James Vanderbeek as himself, so that's kind of...
yeah, and help me out here. James Vanderbeek, that's a name I've heard a lot. He is who?
In the 90s, he was in Dawson's Creek.
Oh, okay.
And then since then, he's kind of been, you know, playing a tool over and over. So it's kind of funny.
His name is kind of used as a punchline.
Right.
At times.
And he does it himself.
I got
you.
Okay.
You know, good with that. On the 15th, Girls, the new show on HBO, it's a Judd Apatow comedy. And New York Magazine just recently said it really lives up to the hype. So I noticed Entertainment Weekly gave it an A. So it's the story of four young women making it. Kind of sounds like Sex and the City when it first came out. But it's Judd Apatow, so it's probably a little dirtier. Mm-hmm. On the 17th, Mission Impossible 4 comes out on DVD.
All right.
Well, a lot of people really like that.
It got good reviews.
And
I didn't see it.
That particular film got really good reviews, so who knows? And then later in the month, on the 22nd, Veep comes out on HBO.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus,
a comedy, so that could be interesting.
And she is the vice president of the United States in this, correct?
Right, and to see her kind of have that free reign on HBO could be interesting. It could also be canceled quickly. We'll see.
Yeah.
Hopefully it works out. On the 24th, The Artist comes out on DVD, which... was, you know, the winner of 5 Oscars, including Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Director. So that's a big film to purchase if you want to catch up and watch what dominated last year's Oscars.
It will be interesting to see. I managed to catch that in the theater, and it was really interesting to see it on a big screen. I'll be interested to see if how well it translates to your television.
Yeah, that could be a hard sell, but it was a hard sell in the theater.
Right.
So
worth your time, though.
It stands at its own, though. Yeah. On the 24th as well, Jack White comes out with his new CD.
Finally.
Of White Stripes fame. And Jonathan Frazen comes out with a new novel, Farther Away. It's essays. So that should be an interesting read. And he sells well, despite, mm-hmm. you know, having years of kind of messed up press, but he sells well. And then at the end of the month, on the 27th, The 5-Year Engagement comes out with Emily Blunt and Jason Segel, romantic comedy. Mm-hmm. Looks like it could be really fun. And, of course, that's a good cast.
Wayne Bell writes the column Culture Club for FayettevilleFlyer.com. Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you.
This is Ozarks at Large. Time now for a trivia question.
And today's winners.
Winners, plural.
3 winners. Each will receive a pair of tickets to the next Sona concert.
Yes, it's the inaugural season finale.
Right. So it's the inaugural season.
Yes.
And it's the finale.
Yes.
Of the inaugural season.
There you go.
It's Saturday night.
It is Saturday night.
All right. So the 3 correct answers will be pulled out of the ceramic cow. And since we're looking for multiple winners,
mm-hmm.
going pretty easy today.
Oh, okay.
Your Northwest Arkansas knowledge should come in handy today.
Okay.
Early in the program, I talked with the gentleman about Doggerland.
Yes.
Which is this submerged land, North Sea. All right. What community in Northwest Arkansas, built in the earliest days of the 20th century, is now submerged because of Beaver Lake? See, you at first you thought this was going to be tough, and then I can tell by your reaction you think it's too easy.
No, I think it's tough.
Really?
Yeah, because I thought you were going to ask me something else. Never
okay.
mind.
Anyway, what Northwest Arkansas community, built in 1901, is now submerged under Beaver Lake?
If you know, give us a call at 522-5823.
That's right, 1-800-522-5823. 3 winners will be picked out of the ceramic cow.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 10th of April, 2012. It's the birthday of the man who said, "Tourists don't know where they've been, travelers don't know where they're going." Paul Theroux, born in Medford, Massachusetts, 1941, after college, went in the Peace Corps, taught school in Malawi, and he wrote. And 10 years after college graduation, he had written 10 books, and it was the 10th that made his reputation, a book called The Great Railway Bazaar, a travelogue of his 4-month trip across Asia. His advice for aspiring writers, leave home, because if you stay home, people will ask you questions that you can't answer. They say, "What are you going to write? Where will you publish it? Who's going to pay you? How will you make a living?" If you leave home, no one asks you questions like that. His advice for aspiring travel writers is the same. Leave home, but without a companion and never by plane. Theroux prefers trains. He said, "Ever since childhood, I have seldom heard a train go by and not wished I was on it." It's the birthday of Anne Lamott, born San Francisco, 1954. She was an alcoholic, an addict, who went into rehab, became a Christian, started teaching writing, published a journal of the first year of her son's life called Operating Instructions, came out in 1993 to great acclaim. Anne Lamott, who says, "Nothing can break the mood of a piece of writing like bad dialogue. My students are miserable when they are reading an otherwise terrific story to the class and then hit a patch of dialogue that is so purple and expositional that it reads like something from a childhood play by the Gabor sisters. I can see the surprise on my students' faces because the dialogue looked okay on paper, yet now it sounds as if it were poorly translated from their native Hindi." It was on this day, 1925, F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby was published. He had a hard time coming up with a good title. Some of his ideas were Among Ash Heaps and Millionaires, On the Road to West Egg, and The High Bouncing Lover. A month before, he'd asked his editor, Maxwell Perkins, to change the title from The Great Gatsby to either Trimalchio or Gold-Hatted Gatsby. Perkins said no, and then Fitzgerald wanted it changed to Under the Red, White, and Blue, but it was too late. And it's the birthday of William Hazlitt, born in Maidstone, England, 1778. When he was 19, he walked 10 miles to hear Samuel Coleridge, and then he walked 200 miles to visit Coleridge at home. He became a journalist and essayist for newspapers. He wrote about art and sports, including boxing, drama, politics. He reviewed books, and then he took up lecturing, which was lucrative. He was an innovator in the development of the personal essay, the essay written in the first person, more discursive, free to wander away from the main theme. William Hazlitt, who said, "Without the aid of prejudice and custom, I should not be able to find my way across the room." Hazlitt said, "The most silent people are generally those who think most highly of themselves." Here's a poem for today by Carl Dennis entitled Ingratitude. Spring, I remembered you all these months. I spoke of the green yard under the snow to my slumped visitors. I sobered the giddy neighbors. You may think you're still happy, I cautioned, but recall the tea roses, the lost leaves of the dogwood tree. But now you have fallen upon us, spring, without warning, so much greener than I remembered. Friends I kept from forgetting laugh at me as they run outside for falling so short in your praise. Ingratitude by Carl Dennis from his New and Selected Poems, 1974 to 2004. Published by Penguin Books, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, written by Heather McPherson. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
All right, time to answer our trivia question.
Yes.
The question was, what town built in 1901 in northwest Arkansas is now submerged under Beaver Lake? I should say there are other communities or towns that have been submerged, but we're looking for the one that was built in 1901 by William Coyne Harvey.
Oh, so Montney.
Montney.
There you go.
Absolutely. Yeah. All correct answers go into the ceramic cow, and then we'll pull three winners out. We'll let you know, and you will receive each a pair of tickets to the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas performance Saturday night, and the tickets will be at Will Call.
Yes.
We'll let Walton Arts Center people know your name, and you just go to Will Call.
KUAF is supported by Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, celebrating the American spirit by uniting the power of art with the beauty of nature. The museum opens at 11 a.m. daily, except Tuesdays. More information is available online at crystalbridges.org. A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Dogpatch.
Dogpatch?
Yep.
You probably never went to Dogpatch, did you?
I did not, but I've learned about it. Yeah. And schmooze and things.
Schmooze. That's right. Schmooze. And Kickapoo Mountain Joy Juice.
Yeah, those things.
Yes. Hey, I want to point out, last week we had a story when you and I went on a hike with Stephen Marquardt and Robert Ginsberg. Mm-hmm. And I ended that piece with a description of us seeing some butterflies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Doug James, who is quite the authority on things that fly in the Ozarks and northwest Arkansas, heard that story, and he emailed me to say that the yellow butterfly was a male eastern tiger swallowtail.
Oh!
The blackish one, a female eastern tiger swallowtail, so same species. And the flight gyrations I saw were, as they appeared when we first saw butterflies, courtship flights.
Oh.
He says it's been going on for a couple of weeks. They overwinter as a dormant chrysalis. Due to the warm winter, more than ever, they seem to have survived. He says he's never before seen so many elsewhere in the spring emergence.
Well, there you go.
So even educated butterflies do it.
Apparently.
Yes. All right. So this is Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And thanks again to everyone who pledged during this fundraiser. We do appreciate it very much.
Yes. A big thank you to everyone, volunteers and people who brought us food, and, of course, everybody listening and those of you who became contributing listeners.
And you and I are back here tomorrow.
We are.
With a brand new edition of Ozarks at Large. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and have a great Tuesday.